From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza appeared to be holding for its second day late Wednesday. We begin our Gaza coverage today with this report from Jocelyn Sambira at the United Nations.
A 72-hour humanitarian ceasefire agreed to by both parties to the Gaza conflict is holding, the UN Relief and Development Agency, UNRWA, confirmed on Wednesday. The truce started on Tuesday at 8 a.m. local time. Meanwhile, Israeli and Palestinian delegations are in Cairo to hold talks under the auspices of the Egyptian government. On the ground, relief workers are scrambling to get emergency aid in the form of food, water, and medical care to those who need it the most. The ceasefire in Gaza has come at a price that is almost too much to bear, the Secretary General told diplomats during an informal briefing on Gaza in the UN General Assembly. The massive death and destruction in Gaza have shocked and shamed the world, he remarked.
More than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed, the vast majority civilians, including hundreds of women and children. Three civilians in Israel were also killed, as well as 64 Israeli soldiers. People on both sides have the right to life, but also the right to a life free from fear.
The senseless cycle of suffering in Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel must end, Mr. Ban Ki-moon said. Speaking via video conference from Egypt, Robert Suri, the special coordinator for the Middle East peace process, echoed this view.
Like the Secretary General, I carry with me an experience of three wars in 6 years between Israel and Gaza. It would be cynical and irresponsible if yet again the outcome of the talks would lead us to the previous status quo. By initial estimates, the destruction wrought on Gaza is worse than that of the 2008-2009 war. The death toll is more grave for sure, including on the Israeli side.
Part of the fundamental issues that are at the root of instability, underdevelopment, and conflict in Gaza have already been identified by the Security Council but remain unimplemented, Mr. Suri elaborated. According to him, the basic equation is ending the blockade in Gaza and addressing Israel's legitimate security needs. The immediate task now is focused on meeting the dire and urgent humanitarian needs of the people of Gaza. Over 500,000 Gazans have been displaced by the conflict with nothing but the clothes on their backs, said Kyung Wha Kang, the UN Deputy Emergency Relief Coordinator. She told the General Assembly that the ceasefire has brought much-needed respite to the people of Gaza, but, Ms. Kang added, it's critical that it holds.
For those who can return to their homes, we must provide the basic supplies they need. We need to find alternative venues for shelters so that the upcoming school year, due to begin in just 3 weeks, is not disrupted. Funding is also urgently required. The UN and partners have appealed for $367 million to address immediate needs. And I strongly encourage member states to respond quickly and generously to the appeal. People need help now.
In the meantime, Israel has ceased its operations within Gaza and has withdrawn its troops from inside. The UN chief says efforts are being made to turn the current calm into a durable ceasefire. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
Peter Maurer, the president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, says he's shocked after seeing the aftermath of the Israeli attacks on Gaza.
I started with a tour of Shujaya neighborhood, where I saw a whole neighborhood in rubbles and buildings destroyed beyond repair. And this leaves me with a deep feeling of shock and being shaken by what I have seen, by anger and frustration also, about the fact that we were not able to prevent what was happening.
Maurer is in Gaza on a three-day mission to assess the situation on the ground following the announcement of the three-day truce. A surgeon with the ICRC says hospitals in Gaza are overwhelmed by the increasing number of casualties and the lack of medical supplies. And as the noise from the Gaza war has begun to dissipate for a few hours while the ceasefire takes hold, one odd fact has become visible. Most Israelis agree with Hamas about the result of the war thus far which could mean that the war on Gaza may backfire politically for Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party. We have this report from Press TV.
The majority of Israelis do not consider Israel's latest onslaught on Gaza as a victory. The survey by the Israeli Institute Panels Politics reveals that 66% of Israel's public believe the month-long war did not achieve its goals. This is while the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had earlier hailed the Gaza offensive as a success. However, the new poll shows that most Israelis' view rather corresponds with that of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, who says Tel Aviv failed to achieve any of its goals in its bloody attacks. Israel began its assaults on July the 8th and tried to cripple Gaza's rocket launching capacity and its underground tunnels, which are the region's lifeline.
Ihab Bisesa was the spokesperson for the Palestinian Unity Government. He accused Israel of war crimes and the rest of the international community as culpable.
Clearly, what happened in Gaza for the last few weeks, it proves that there were war crime scenes that have been committed by the Israeli occupation forces. And the position of the Palestinian government that we will not spare any effort on a diplomatic and political level that will bring justice to the people who paid their lives because of the Israeli fires and missiles against their houses and demolishing. From the beginning, we said and clearly We clearly put it very clear to the international community that it is also part of the shared responsibility with the Palestinian government that the siege and the blockade on Gaza should be lifted, and then our people in Gaza should be clearly granted a safe passage and opening of all borders. This united delegation, a united Palestinian delegation that went to Cairo, presented the Palestinian national demands, which is, I think, it's fair to all human codes and human conventions about the free passage and opening of all the borders. So simply, there is no coming back from these demands. This is a very clear message to the international community. We have been engaged with the international community as a state of Palestine under the occupation for the last few months. Look what happened for the last 9 months of negotiations with the Israeli government. What have we gained in terms of a political stability? Nothing but approval of building thousands of settlements in the West Bank, shooting Palestinians. More than 50 people were shot dead by the Israeli troops or the settlers in the West Bank. And you look, what is the situation in East Jerusalem? Nothing has been achieved during the last months in terms of a political stability. So what we are saying here, that it is part of the shared responsibility between Palestine as a state under occupation, as an international community, to give it more attention in terms of the political assistance and the economic assistance. The demands which is being presented by the Palestinian United Delegation in Cairo, it is the national demands of the Palestinians, and it is now the role of the active politics in terms of the international community and even within the regional powers to push towards accepting these demands by the Israeli occupation. Otherwise, there will be no stability. The Israeli occupation government continued to undermine all international efforts, not only for the last 9 months, but also for the last few years, not proceeding with any political stability. We are demanding our independence, our state of Palestine, free of occupation and these illegal settlements built on our land.
Some reports are surfacing with claims that there is irrefutable evidence that Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was shot down by machine gun fire from Ukrainian military fighter jets and not by a rocket. First, we have this interview with Michael Bochurkiu, an OSCE monitor from Canada, by the Canadian news agency CBC's Susan Ormiston last month, almost 2 weeks after the crash.
There have been two or three pieces of fuselage that have been really pockmarked. It almost looks like machine gun fire, very, very strong machine gun fire that has left these unique marks that we haven't seen anywhere else. We've also been asked, for example, have we seen any examples of a missile? Well, no, we haven't. That's the answer. And even if it was there, we don't have those trained eyes to pick that up. But now there are experts here who would be able to.
Ormiston, the CBC reporter conducting the interview, began the segment by announcing, quote, "The wreckage was still smoldering when a small team from the OSCE got there. No other officials arrived for days," closed quote. In addition, a retired Lufthansa pilot has said that the bullet holes and the plane fragments strongly indicate that it was the pilot who was directly targeted by fire from fighter jets. Peter Hysenko in an article entitled Shocking Analysis of the Shootdown of Malaysian MH17, which was published July 30th at anderveldonline.com, wrote that the entrance and exit holes of bullets only make sense when considered in tandem with a report from a Spanish air traffic controller that he had seen two Ukrainian fighter jets in the immediate vicinity of the plane. Isenko wrote that, when considering the types of armament that the Ukrainian Su-23 carries, a double-barreled 30mm gun equipped with a 250-round magazine of incendiary shells and splinter explosive shells, the holes begin to make sense. In his judgment, the plane was shot down by a pair of Ukrainian fighters who targeted the pilot and riddled the cockpit with machine gun fire from two positions. The inspectors at the crash site have had their work repeatedly interrupted by shelling and air attacks from the Ukrainian Air Force. Meanwhile, the humanitarian situation in East Ukraine was the subject of discussion at the UN Security Council, prompted by a request by the Russian ambassador, Vitaly Churkin.
Thank you, Mr. President. We thank the Director of Coordination and Response of OCHA, Mr. Ginge, for the briefing on the situation in eastern Ukraine. We think that OCHA and other humanitarian agencies should regularly inform the Council of the humanitarian situation in the region, provide objective statistics of the situation of civilians, including data on those wounded, killed, as well as the destruction of civilian entities. On a human scale, the situation in the east, in particular in Donetsk and Lugansk, is disastrous. Today, with all certainty, there's a need to speak about a true war. The ICRC has officially recognized that there is an internal armed conflict in the east of Ukraine. In spite of international agreements, including the 17 April Geneva Agreement and that from Berlin and on 2 July, which were signed on to by the Ukrainian government, Kyiv continues to step up its military operations, taking hundreds and thousands of lives with it. According to information, the punitive militia are playing a leading role. They're subordinate to no armed forces in Ukraine. They are carrying out the orders of certain leaders of the Security Council of the country and are financed by local oligarchs. The overflights on cities have become a daily reality. Artillery, tanks, as well as Grad rockets are used. There's continuing information from locals about the use of phosphorus bombs and cluster bombs. There's indiscriminate shelling of housing blocks and critical civilian infrastructure. In many small towns, about 80% of houses have been destroyed. According to most conservative estimates, more than 600 buildings have fallen. Today, a rocket attack was conducted in Shatyorsk. On 2 August, there was a shelling by the Ukrainian authority of the city of Pervomaysk, where homes were destroyed, as well as two electrical power plants, hospitals, and others. Because of the shelling of the Ukrainian armed forces, shells continue to fall into Russia. There are about 20 of such cases on 3rd of August. A Ukrainian army mine erupted on the crossing point of Gukova in the Rostov Oblast, where OSCE monitors were working. According to the most conservative estimates of international humanitarian agencies, there are more than 1,367 killed and thousands of wounded, including children. These are worrisome numbers. And just in one day in the city of Gorlov, 40 people were killed. In the area of military operations, there are more than 4 million people. Of them, more than 200,000 have been left without drinking water. There's a critical health and epidemiological situation in Lugansk. There's no electricity going to houses. There's no water either. Because of shelling, there's no clean water. There's a lack of telephone communications, and even waste is not being cleaned up. Ukrainians have begun to leave the country en masse. Almost 800,000 Ukrainians have come to Russia since the beginning of the crisis. They have come to the migration services to legalize their situation. About 170,000 of them have done so. And there have been centers opened for the refugees. Our country stands ready to undertake this great burden and do not need material assistance from outside. We stand ready to provide humanitarian assistance to Ukrainians on our own. The most dramatic situation is in the east of the Ukraine on the health front. The majority of doctors have been evacuated. There's a need to understand that in the areas of military clashes, the most vulnerable have been left, who have no way of leaving. The Kiev authorities, it seems, are not interested at all. We've made multiple appeals to them regarding the creation of humanitarian corridors to evacuate children and the vulnerable, including child orphans, and also regarding sending humanitarian assistance from Russia. But Kiev has refused all of these proposals scornfully. The international Russia calls upon the international community to take emergency measures to improve the humanitarian situation in the east of Ukraine. Because of this, on 4th of August, the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, once again sent an official appeal to UN humanitarian agencies as well as those from the OSCE, the Council of Europe, and the ICRC to convene a humanitarian mission. We'd like to send a convoy with Russian humanitarian assistance under the aegis and with the accompaniment of the ICRC to Donetsk and Lugansk, as well as to other inhabited areas of Ukraine, where IDPs are concentrated from the east. We stand ready to act with optimal transparency. Let the International Committee to monitor the convoys, their transport routes, and the distribution of aid. We think first and foremost there's a need to provide food, medicine, and medical equipment, as well as water purification systems and generators. Sir, there are many cases when the provision of assistance to civilians suffering from an armed conflict is very difficult. This applies to the situation, for example, in South Sudan or in Iraq and Syria, in those areas controlled by terrorist organizations. The situation in the east of Ukraine means that there needs to be a halt to the politicking, and there needs to be a true following of international humanitarian principles. And finally, Kiev's approach to violently repress the eastern regions will have most difficult consequences for the whole Ukrainian people, and this is simply regrettable. Thank you.
Both Lugansk and Donetsk have seen heavy shelling, which has destroyed homes and essential infrastructure. Power, water and sewer, and even garbage collection have been cut off for the nearly 2 million residents of the besieged cities. RT's Maria Finoshina filed this report from Lugansk.
Lugansk is a shadow of its former self. It was once a flourishing regional center with a population of 500,000. Today, it is largely abandoned and dangerous. Destroyed schools and hospitals, silent reminders of an ongoing conflict.
This is the hotel in the center of Lugansk where we used to stay. Just 2 weeks ago, there were guests here, mostly journalists, but also Ukrainians running from violence in the towns of Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. They used to be two major epicenters of the large-scale military operation here in eastern Ukraine. There was also a Chinese restaurant on the seventh floor, but now, as you can see, the hotel has been shut down. This sign says, hotel is closed.
The further we go from the center, the greater the destruction. Olga's house was damaged when a shell exploded in her garden. Instead of the flowers she planted there, is now a deep crater.
Если раньше бои проходили за городом, а сейчас страдают местные люди, дети.
Like other locals here who haven't already fled the fighting, Olga has taken shelter in a basement.
Я сегодня побежала туда.
2 минуты обратно.
Полчаса начали бахать. Меня начало вот так всю трясти, я бросила все и прибежала опять сюда.
Many of those sheltering underground are sick and desperate.
А как я думаю? Я не знаю как. Я вообще в шоке. Я вообще не знаю, какой мы.
Помощь надеяться.
As we are speaking, the electricity drops out. Blackouts are a constant problem here. The lines were apparently repaired just before we arrived.
There
is a shelter under almost every apartment building in Lugansk, and they are rarely empty.
This is another basement that has recently become home to local residents. And it's not that they hide here at the time of the intense shelling and bombardment. You can see they literally leave here. Every family has its own place here, like an apartment building, but underground.
In one of the corridors, we meet Artem, the youngest resident we've seen here so far. He shares many of the fears of the older people here. At 9 p.m. every day, people in different basements recite the same prayer. They ask for God to protect them and bring them peace. But as the shelling continues around them, the furthest they dare to plan ahead is tomorrow, when they say they will meet here again. Mariv Noshinati, Lugansk, Ukraine.
Despite the catastrophic conditions facing residents in the East Ukraine, the U.S. Deputy Ambassador Rosemary DiCarlo denied that the situation was urgent enough to call for an emergency session of the Council.
Mr. President, we appreciate the ability of the Secretariat to arrange emergency briefings on short notice. There are times when such urgency is merited. We question whether the situation we're discussing today meets the standard of urgency, especially as we will be discussing the overall situation in Ukraine on Friday.
After all who had wished to speak said their piece, Churkin responded to DiCarlo's remarks.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. Well, unfortunately, a number of members of the Security Council haven't heard our call to reject politicizing this discussion of the humanitarian situation in eastern Ukraine through providing humanitarian assistance to the population in need. Someone, as always, has protected the Kyivian authorities by distorting the role of the Russian Federation. Others repeated speeches that they have said previously, given previously at Security Council meetings, and some have said that the killing and wounding of individuals as a result of the armed conflict in Ukraine is not worthy of separate discussion. Such propaganda was repeated by the representative of Ukraine as well. We're grateful to those members of the Council who shared our concern, our alarm. We'd like to again reaffirm our readiness to closely cooperate with the humanitarian agencies, with all relevant organizations, all relevant institutions who not only can, but who must play their role in providing assistance and help to the population in eastern Ukraine. We cherish a hope that today's Security Council meeting will serve to promote coordination of our common efforts with them.
And we now bring you part three of that interview with American journalist Patrick Lancaster on the ground in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine from this past Saturday. The characterization here in the media has been that the inspectors couldn't get to the site because of the Donetsk People's Republic units or irregulars or whatever. In other words, the rebels are preventing the inspectors from doing their job. Is that an inaccurate statement?
Right now, I think that's a inaccurate statement. I believe the fighting in the conflict was keeping them from getting to the crash sites as far as in the last days. The first 2 days of after the crash, there was some problems in the Donetsk People's Republic forces that were at the crash site because I think they just weren't sure how to handle it when the OSCE observers showed up. Right. So for the first 2 days, there was some resistance by the Donetsk forces there as far as giving them proper access. But I was there the first day, the first time they were given the proper access on the Sunday after the accident, 3 days after the crash. And at that point, it seemed like the orders had made its way down the chain of command, and the OSCE forces were given very proper bodyguards. In my position, in my opinion, the soldiers that were given to them seemed much more professional than the normal ones that had been at the crash site before. Right. They did a very strict, made a very strict perimeter of the areas that the OSCE observers were inspecting at each given time. It seemed it was going very, very well for them getting access to the site. But in the following days after the fighting started, then that's when the lack of access happened to the crash site as far as the OSCE observers go. And that was because of the fighting near the crash site.
So now let's be clear about the facts on the ground. The crash site was in territory that was already in the control of the Donetsk People's Republic, correct?
Yes.
And so their fire would be defending the territory that they already hold, and the provocation would be an attempted invasion of that territory by the Ukrainian army, correct?
I believe the fighting occurred from the Ukrainian army coming into the area around the crash sites, and I have no way to say who fired first, Ukrainian army came into that area that was not previously held by the Ukrainian army, that area of Ukraine, and then that's when the fighting erupted, when they moved to siege the different towns in that area.
Right. Okay. So because that fact isn't reported either. I mean, if you process the information that's spread out, because they accuse the Donetsk People's Republic forces of, tampering with the crime scene and all this stuff, then you understand that they're in control of the site. And then you understand that fighting is offense, Ukrainian army, defense, Donetsk People's Republic, because they hold the territory. But they don't put that together. Instead, somehow the fighting and the denial of access is still the fault of the Donetsk People's Republic, rather than a failure on the part of the parties to say, okay, look, we're all going to keep the territory that we hold right now. No one's going to redeploy forces or fight or attempt to recover territory from either side. These guys can come in, do their work. Anybody who needs to come in has safe escort in and out, does their work, and then leaves. And then we go back to fighting. That I guess that's the basis of the agreement that was supposed to take place, and maybe it is now. Is it quiet now?
I have not been to the crash sites in the last few days, so I can't really speculate on that. I was.
Yeah, maybe you could tell us about where you were the past few days.
Well, day before yesterday, I was in Slavyansk trying to cover investigate some reports of some mass graves that were supposedly found. But on the way back from Slavyansk, I was on a bus, and we were traveling through Kramatorsk, and we made it to the south side of Kramatorsk, where there's a Ukrainian army checkpoint. And at that point, the bus stopped, and the soldiers who were wearing the Berkut insignias and the Ukrainian flag was flying there because it was well in the Ukrainian territory. Mm-hmm. They had all the men get off the bus, and they checked all the documents. They checked our documents, and we showed them our passports and the only press credentials we actually had at the time were the Donetsk People's Republic press passes that are given by the local administration building here in Donetsk, by the press center. And eventually we had to show them that. But they seemed, the soldiers seemed unsure what to do with us because, just because they didn't know. But then they told us, wait. They kept the bus waiting. They said someone will come soon. And then three masked soldiers that seemed to be a little bit more high-ranking came over and took our documents and then told us we had to wait longer. But finally, after about 2 hours of us waiting there, they sent our bus on. And they had our bus just leave us there, and they told us we could not take our bus. We had to stay and wait for the security service, they called it.
We will bring you the conclusion of that interview tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.